We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
My name's Tip Collins, and I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
And I ain't had a drink all day long.
Yeah.
I didn't hurt nobody today. I haven't hurt myself. I worked all week and paid my way. On the way home from work every single night, all my neighbors waved at me with all five fingers. Pulled in my driveway, and my kids come running out and said, "Daddy's home." My dog comes running out, man. I got a little dog. He's about a pound and a half, little Yorkie Terrier. He's the baddest little son of a bitch you ever seen in your life. He thinks he's a mastiff. Got the heart of one, I'll tell you. Anyway, it's really an honor to be asked to come here and share with you all this afternoon. I want to thank the committee for inviting me. And it's been just a pleasure getting to know Ron and these other outlaws. And my home group is, well, we got close to 1,000 years in prison amongst us. And we take recovery very, very seriously. My sobriety date is May 12th, 1984. I haven't had to have a drink or fix my breakfast in a spoon ever since that day. I was raised in Vista, California. My parents are Indian. My mother's Choctaw and Irish, and my father's Sioux and Irish. And my cousins lived with us. We lived in an all-Hispanic neighborhood. Nobody spoke English. And me and my brother Bill, we were born with white skin, freckles, white hair, and blue eyes. And when we went outside, the Mexicans wanted to beat our ass. When we went in the house, the Indians wanted to beat our ass. Ain't none of that makes me an alcoholic. It just made me mean, you know, and My daddy was a drinker. Man, my daddy loved to drink, and my mother loved to fight. Now, just share it a very general way. You know, he'd be getting later and later. My mom, we had hardwood floors, and she was a marcher, you know. And you could always tell her attitude how loud she was marching, you know. And about midnight, man, she's pounding, you know. And I go, "Oh, man, me and my brother are going. It's going to hit the fan tonight." You know, pretty soon you hear that pickup come up, bouncing off the curbs, park in the middle of the lawn. If you looked out the windows right then, you'd see all my neighbors grabbing a lawn chair, you know, and trying to get a good seat. My mother would come flying out that door with a butcher knife. She'd go for the driver's door. He'd bail out the passenger door, you know, and the neighbors would cheer. And that was just Monday night, you know. Should have been there for holidays. Ain't none of that makes me an alcoholic either. My daddy taught me exactly what alcohol will do to a man, what it'll do to a family, what it'll do to a career. I had no illusions about alcohol. I didn't want to be no alcoholic. I swear to God I was never going to be an alcoholic. I lived in the barrio, you know, and the guys, the tough guys, there were these dudes, and their hair was slicked back. They had shades on, and they were just cool, you know, leaning against the wall. They were all drug addicts, so I wanted to be a drug addict. I can't blame my alcoholism on the school or anything else, you know. On my family or the neighborhood, I've always blamed it on the San Diego Unified School District. When I was in sixth grade, they had this great idea. It's time to teach all these young kids about that stuff we don't talk about in A&A. And they took us in this hall, and they had these two clowns come up and try to scare us. And they showed us this flick. And they turned the lights back on, and I hit my buddy Balto in the ribs. I said, "Can you get some of that?" And he said, "Oh, yeah." I said, "My dad smokes that stuff." I said, "Cool, man." And so the next day, I said, "You get it?" He goes, "Yeah." He says, "Meet me after school." So I said, met him after school. He says, what do we do?" He says, "Well, we got to go boost some wine." I said, "Some wine? What for?" He goes, "I don't know." But my daddy always drinks wine when he smokes this stuff. And, you know, we didn't want to make any mistakes. We went down to the market. I stole a short dog of sweet red port. He got a little bottle of Muscatel. We went down this canyon. He fired that cigarette up, took a hit off of it, handed it to me. I took a hit, made me cough. But I looked at this stuff, man. It had this real fancy screw cap bottle. And I pulled that off, man. It was a beautiful purple color. And I took a big pull on her, hit my belly, and jumped out and landed on my shoes. But I ain't no quitter. You know, I took another pull on her, you know, and you got to kind of do that yo-yo thing, man. You got to pinch your nose and hold it, and it kind of bounces, and then pretty soon it goes down. You know, and you take another little pull and start, and if you get down to the end, man, I'm just going down smooth. I look at Balto, he's still quieted down, and he's sucking on this little cigarette. He says, I went, you going to drink that? He said, "Nah, man, that stuff is vile." And I said, he said, "Knock yourself out," and I drank his. And I had my very first spiritual awakening. I don't know what liquor did, y'all. Alcohol was the most incredible thing that had ever happened to me in my life. I was laying there and I was looking up at the sky. You know, and I'd been raised in incredible violence inside and outside of my house at all times. And I wasn't even aware of it because it had always been that way. That was my reality. But I was terrified my whole life, you know. When I was laying there that night, for the very first time, I wasn't afraid of anything in this world. Man, my skin fit. Everything was calm inside of me. I knew I had a right to be here. You know, my skin started turning a little bit darker. My eyes turned brown. And, man, I was good to go. And I knew all about these third step of Alcoholics Anonymous long before I met any of you folks. You know, when I was 12 years old, I knew I was powerless over this world. And I knew my life was a mess. And I drank this magic stuff, and I came to believe there was a power greater than anything. And I immediately turned my will and life over to it, and I never looked back. You know, A year later, I got in an argument with a teacher and knocked him out with a pipe. It was a misunderstanding, you know. And it was the second time I'd done it, so they expelled me from the San Diego Unified School District. And I walked home, and my mom was waiting for me. My mom, God bless her, I love her. She has severe Alzheimer's, and I've been taking care of her for a long, long time. Well, my mom was the meanest woman I've ever met in my life, man. She's a woman you must respect, the woman who must be obeyed. And I saw her stab my dad 3 different times. I saw her knock my grandfather out right at the dinner table with a frying pan and drag him outside of the yard. One time a neighbor was yelling at me and she snuck up behind him and knocked him cold with a shovel. You know, you gotta respect a woman like that. My mom, she's standing there and she's got this plastic bag with this green vegetable matter in it. And she said, "So you got your ass kicked out of school, huh?" I said, "Yep." She said, "What's this?" I went, "Probably just what you think it is." She said, "That's it. You're out. Get off my property." I've been waiting for her to tell me that since I was 5. I went over to a friend of mine's house in Carlsbad. It's about 1963. And he said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "Man, I don't know." And he says, "Well, check this out." And he brings out this newspaper article. And he says, "Look, all these young people are going up to San Francisco. And all they do up there is they get high. And they listen to music. And make love." Man, when I was 13, I loved music. I was obsessed with music until I got into my 60s, you know. I share in a very general way about that experience. I'll tell you straight up, I was the worst hippie that ever got to San Francisco. I'm a fighter. You know, these people were pacifists. And if someone would say something to me, I'd knock them out, you know. And they'd give peace a chance. I'd go, "Bite me," you know. And And I've just always been grateful to the God of my understanding that I'm not allergic to penicillin, you know, because that music was nasty. I found out what my true calling was right off the bat, man. I found out that what I am is I'm a capitalist pig, you know. I saw all this white bread in there. They didn't know what time of day was. They wanted this product. All my friends come from Mexico. You know, I went, they give it away where I live. And I called my buddy Balto. And I said, "Balto, you're not going to believe what these people pay for this stuff." And he didn't believe. He says, "Hey, man, come on down. Let's go talk to the family." So, you know, I came back down south and we went down to Rosarito and I talked to this family down there and we set up a little business. And I worked for that family for the remainder of my life until I was about 30 years old. And until I couldn't be trusted anymore, you know. And we started a business, import and export cash, and you know, and it was real good. I tell you straight up, I ain't gonna go into it. You know the deal. You know, I did everything I ever wanted to do, and I did everything I ever had to do, and I never looked back on any of it. You know, I went to prison down in Mexico when I was 16 years old. I went to La Mesa Federal Penitentiary. I was there for a year and a half, and I got my PhD in criminology. I learned how to stay out of prison in there, and I learned had some real great teachers down there. The family I worked for basically ran that prison. I had no problems whatsoever in there, and I got back out, and I did what I do. And I got arrested again on my 18th birthday, 6 months after I got out of there with 27 felonies. I was living with this girl. She was pregnant. And they took me, and I never got to see her again. And I never got to find out the baby. I tried to write. I tried to call. I tried to do whatever I could, but nobody would contact me. And I sat in that San Diego County jail down there for almost a year and a half fighting that case. And finally, three other guys that were with me, they pled guilty, and they cut me and another guy loose. And I got out, and I went to go try to find this baby, and I found the family, and they said, "Stay away from us. You've done enough damage to our family. Don't come near us." And, you know, and I respected that, and I left them alone. But I always wondered about that kid. You know, about that time, a company called Roar came out with this product. Anybody here ever gone to jail for just being stupid in public? I mean, nothing criminal. I went to jail for being stupid in public 3 times 1 week. And I've been running around with a little girl. She was 15 years old. And she came from a real rich family. And, you know, I'd no sooner get to my bunk and start to lay down, and they'd say, "Roll up." I go, "Oh, shit." And I get my stuff and get to the gate, and they said, "Bail's been made." And I went, "Oh, man, just let me go back to my bunk." And And every time, you know, three times in 1 week, this little girl bailed me out of jail. And she's standing down there waiting for me. And the last time she did it, I said, why in the hell do you keep bailing me out of jail? She looked at me with big brown eyes. She looked at me and she had kind of a confused look on her face. And she said, well, what else should I do? So I married her. Yeah, betcha. That's a keeper. I don't know nothing about love, but I know a lot about jail. And any woman, don't go to bed till I'm out, man. I want them on my side, and I don't want them to be able to testify against me, you know. Kathy was the greatest crime partner I've ever had in my life. Man, oh man, me and that girl had some good times. She was in a gunfight with me one time, backed me up, man. I was real so proud of her. She just came out guns blazing, man. I said, go, baby. Oh, man. I got busted again and did another year in jail for heroin beef and got back out. I had this real unreasonable parole officer. He wanted me to get a job. And I don't do that, you know. I got my case transferred to Oregon. And if anybody's on parole and got a really unreasonable parole officer, and talk to me after the meeting, I'll show you a real easy way to get moved. But I got up there and I went to a little town, Coos Bay, Oregon. And I went to the parole department, and there was this guy comes out. He pulls up. He's in a Volkswagen bus with flowers on it, you know, and he's got long hair. He says, hey, man, just be cool. I said, I'm always cool, man. And he said, all right, well, give me a call once in a while. I said, you got it, pal. That was the last time I ever saw that guy, you know. Now, that's someone you can work with, you know. And my wife told me, she goes, I'm pregnant. And I went, you're what? She goes, I'm pregnant. You know, I'm going to tell you something, a little inside secret I don't know what you're going to talk about, you know, back then, because I'm a tough guy. I don't talk about shit like that. What I wanted to be more than anything in this world, as long as I could remember, was to be a father. I wanted a son. I wanted a family. I wanted the respect of my neighbors. I wanted everything that I never had when I was a kid. I wanted that so bad. And I got real excited about having this boy. And I started changing my life. I said, you know, I'm going to stop doing what I've been doing. I'm going to get a job. I'm going to start doing it by the book. And I started doing that. One day we went down to the hospital, and I sat in one room. And they came back out after a bit, and they bring in this little baby boy, and they put him in my arms. And I had my second spiritual awakening. And they put that child in my arms. My heart exploded in my chest. And I never understood what true love was before in my life. What absolute, total, unconditional love for another human being was. And it just blew my whole psyche apart. And I promised this little boy, I'm going to protect you. Ain't nobody ever going to hurt you, man. You're going to have all this stuff. You're my pal. And I meant it with everything I had. You know, and I just kept doing it, man, going straight. I wasn't getting loaded, wasn't getting drinking, wasn't doing anything, just going to work. And I got off parole right after that, and I got offered a real good job down in California from my stepdad. And so we came back down to California, and my wife said, I'm pregnant again. And, you know, and after a while, I ended up in this hospital, and they came out after a little bit, and they bring this little girl, and they put this little girl in my arms. And I had my third spiritual awakening because I fell absolutely head over heels in love with this child. I said, you're my princess. I'm never going to let no one hurt you. You're going to have all the stuff, baby. And I meant it with everything I had. And I continued doing what I was doing. I was working. I was making good money. I'm staying away from everybody, you know. And on September 6, 1976, my wife and daughter went to school. They were going to get school closed. School was getting ready to start. And I was playing with a Frisbee with my son out in the driveway. It was a real hot day, Santa Ana. A friend of mine came over. we had a smoke, man. It was real hot. I was thirsty. And, you know, I just got, I wanted a beer. I wanted a cold beer so bad. And I just, car wasn't there. I told my son, I said, listen, you wait right here. I'm going to be right back. And I got on my bike and I went up to the store, go get a six-pack of beer. And when I came back down the road, the police were in front of my house and the fire department and all the neighbors. And I got up there and I found out my son had chased me out of the driveway and he'd been run over by a truck. And I got to that little boy and his head was split open and I could see his brains and ribs were protruding out of his chest. And a big piece of me died. I sat in intensive care with that little boy for the next year. I don't know nothing about God. My family didn't go to church. My dad knew his last name. That's all I knew. But I tried to cry out to this God. I heard people talk about it. I said, give me back my son. I'll do anything. And I'll do anything in this world if you just let me have my son back. And my little boy, he survived, sort of. The little boy he was gone forever. There was so much brain damage, and I got back a child that couldn't hear and couldn't talk. And he emotionally and mentally never got past the age of about 4.5 years old. And he was in and out of the hospital the rest of his life. Same time this was going on, my brother Bill, who's anything I've told you, my brother was, he was my shadow. We were 11 months apart. We backed each other's play, right or wrong, under any conditions, anywhere. And my brother came down with a disease called schizophrenia. And my family had him put in a hospital. And he called me from that hospital. He said, Kip, get me out of here. I said, are you okay? He said, yeah, man, they're giving me these pills. Get me out of here. Do whatever you got to do. Get me out of here. You know, and I went against the family, everybody, the doctors, everything. And I got my brother out of there, and I brought him back home with me. He lived with me. He had a mobile home right across the creek from my place. And I got to make some money, man. I'm getting bills today now. I'm getting bills. They don't come in an envelope. They come in a cardboard box, you know. I've gone through all my insurance, and I got to make some money. And I called my family down in Mexico, and I tried to put this scam together. And I got it all set on a deal in New York, and I called, told my brother, I said, man, I'm going to need you to watch my daughter here, I'm going to be gone for about 3 days. And he looked at me, man, and he was kind of shaking, and he says, you can't go. I said, what do you mean I can't go? I go, you know the deal. I got no choice now. I got to go. And he says, no. He says, I'm coming apart, man. I don't know what's going on. He says, man, don't leave. Please don't go. And I told him, I said, man, I got to go. And I pulled out a wad of cash, gave him some money. Money's fixed everything all my life. And I said, just hang tight, man. It's always been me and you, always will. As soon as I get back, we'll fix this thing. Just hang tough. And I got in this cab, and they were taking me to the airport, and I looked in the back, and my brother was standing there holding my little girl's hand, and he was crying. And I've never seen my brother cry in my whole life. And it kind of gave me a kind of a weird feeling, you know. In this deal, I got back to New York, and the thing went sideways on me. Instead of 3 days, I was gone for 3 weeks. When I got back, my daughter met me at the driveway, and I said, where's my brother? She goes, I ain't seen him since right after you left. I said, what do you mean you ain't seen him? She goes, he ain't been around. And I walked back over, went across that creek, and went over to his trailer. And, man, when I got close to it, I already knew. But I opened that door, and, man, my brother's head fell out. And it was just a big pile of maggots laying in that doorway. My brother's head fell at my foot. He had blown his head off 3 days after I left. And another big, giant piece of me died that day. I'll tell you all straight up. I thank God that I'm an alcoholic. If alcohol would not do for me what alcohol did for me, I guarantee you, you'd have a different speaker here today. But alcohol does something real magic to me. Alcohol takes away guilt instantly. It stops those pictures that are on the front of my brain, just kind of muddles them up. Allows me to function in this world one day at a time, reasonably comfortable. And it stops the screaming in the morning. And I'm drinking. I'm drinking. I'm drinking like I've never drank before. I lose all my connections with Mexico. They don't want nothing to do with me. I'm real unpredictable now. This other man, he's paying more attention to my wife than I am. You know, and she left with him. And she left me with this little girl. My son was in a special hospital. My little girl was crying. She was scared to death. She goes, what's going on? She goes, everybody's leaving. Everybody's dying. She goes, you're acting crazy. What's going to happen to me? I said, just a minute. We just hit a bump in the road, baby. I said, I don't need nobody. It's just you. I'm going to catch my breath here in just a minute. I'm going to put it all back together. Don't you worry about a thing. And I got her in bed, and I got her calmed down, got her to sleep. About that time, a guy knocked on my door, and he came in with this stuff I'd never heard of up to that point. You guys look like a pretty classy crowd. I doubt if you have either. Down in Vista, we call it Mad Dog. If there's any newcomers here, and you ain't want what we got, man, go get you some Mad Dog. You're an alcoholic like I am. It'll run your rusty ass back in these rooms so fast. I always called Mad Dog an event drink. Every time I drank Mad Dog, something happened. I was a hardcore wino paneling on the street. Some guy would come by and offer me a bottle of Mad Dog, and I would hesitate. Well, I drank this bottle of Mad Dog, man, and the next thing I know, this lady is tapping me on the shoulder and says, excuse me, sir, you got to get off the airplane. I said, here, where the hell am I? And I looked up. I'm in this big, wide-body jet. It's completely empty. And my little girl's sound asleep right next to me. And I'm going, where am I? She said, you're in Fort Lauderdale. I said, Florida? She goes, yeah. I said, I hate Fort Lauderdale. She goes, I don't know nothing about it, man. You got to get off the airplane. And I said, all right. So, you know, my daughter's asleep. And she's 5. She probably knows what's up, you know. So, you know, really, you gotta look cool, you know? And I said, we're here. Hoping she's gonna throw me a bone, you know? And she looked out the window and went, oh, goody. And I went, okay. Let's go. And I walk off the airplane and I start looking around. I've got some bags I didn't realize. And I got a lot of money on me. That's a good. And I called a cab. I said, you know, take me to a nice hotel and stop at a liquor store. On the way there, I need to figure out what's happened here. And I come to, butt naked, 4-point restraints. For just a second, I thought I might have missed something really cool. But then I saw that green color of the walls. You guys know what I'm talking about? Yeah. I've been in prison in 3 different countries, man. They paint them all the same color. Must buy in bulk or something. When you wake up and you're butt naked in 4-point restraints and all the walls are green, the windows have bars on them, it's not a good sign. You know, you probably weren't walking a little lady across a crosswalk the night before. I found out it was a misunderstanding. Allegedly. They picked me up in this hotel lobby, butt naked, at about 3 o'clock in the morning, trying to introduce myself to this young lady. I'm from Southern California. You guys know that ain't no big deal. You know? Man, these people back in a Bible Belt, they take that stuff real serious, you know? They call the cops, and the cops, I heard it was quite a show. They said they were chasing me all over the hotel, you know, and I was running. And they finally cheated, you know? They used chemical warfare on me and electrics and beat me with clubs and took me to the county jail. I was out of my mind. The captain at the jail said, get him out of here. Take him down to Cantle Mill Health. That guy's just nuts. And they came in there, man, and they gave me a big geez of Thorazine and calmed my butt right down. So I get to talk to this psychiatrist, and I'm saying, you know, this is all a mistake. I've been through a lot of trauma right now, and I tell you what, I'll make a deal. If you let me out of here, I give you my word, I will not, before the sun sets today, I will be out of this state, and I won't come back. That works in a lot of places. He said, be gone, you know? And I don't know where my kid is, but you can't say anything. You know, they might call the cops or something. You don't want to have to deal with them on that. You know, so I'm hoping I got a matchbook or something, but I'll find her. And I got my clothes. I hit the street, and my little girl was walking up with this young couple that I'd met there the night before. And she come up, grabbed, jumped in my arms, and I said, come on, baby, we're getting out of Florida. I told you this place sucks, you know. I mean, we were there for 24 hours. And I'd love to tell you that was it, but that was the beginning of a long, long, long run, and I'm not going to go into all of it. I tell you, I lived in five different states over the next 3 years, and every place I left was just like that, left it on a dead run. Everywhere I went, I promised my daughter I was going to get her back in school. I was going to get a job. I was going to get a home. I was going to get something going on. And every single place we went, the same thing happened, because I only know how to live one way. Last place, we were running out of Georgia. And I was on this bus, Greyhound bus, coming into Oklahoma. And I met this young man. He was a nice Christian young man. My daughter really took a liking to him. And I was talking to him, and he said, you know, why don't you come out? My family, we got a big place out in the country, and we got a ranch, and we could always use help out there. And, you know, we'll help you get your daughter in school. We got a little apartment there. You guys can have your own little house there, and my dad will give you a job, and we'll help you get your life back together. And I said, oh, thanks. He says, but you can't drink on my property. I said, what? He said, we don't drink. And I'm going, cancels that out, you know. And but my little girl, she's looking at me and pleading with me. I mean, this is what I've been promising her for years. And here we're getting it offered to us on a silver plate. So I agreed to it, you know. They were the nicest people in the world. They did exactly what they said they were going to do. They were some of the kindest, lovingest people I've ever met in my life. God bless them. You know, and after 2 weeks, I got a paycheck. And the other guy that worked out there, he says, I'm going into town to cash my check. And want to come with me? I'll buy you a beer. Yo. I come walking in that house late that night. I got blood on my clothes, and it ain't mine. My little girl looks at me. She knows what's up. I said, come on, we're getting out of here. She grabbed a pillowcase, stuck a few things in it, grabbed her little raggedy old doll, and I washed up and grabbed a couple of things, and we went out and stole that man's pickup truck. Got to the bus station, and I bought a ticket and a bottle of wine. Passed out on that bus, and I come to in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And when I woke up, my little girl was crying, and she was rocking back and forth, holding her stomach, and she's crying. I said, what's the matter? She goes, Daddy, I'm so hungry. You ain't fed me. I said, as soon as we stop, I'll get you something to eat. And I got off that bus in Albuquerque, walked in that little liquor store, got her a sandwich, got me a bottle of wine, because I was sick. And I got up to go pay for it. And I only had enough money in my pants to pay for one or the other, and I had to put her sandwich back. And I've done a lot of things in this world that I'm so ashamed of, I'd never share from this podium. But I've never done anything that shamed me more than that moment. Thank God, there was a black lady sitting there, elderly black lady, and she looked over, she never said a word to me, but she looked over at my little girl and she said, honey, she goes, my daughter made me this big lunch, and I hate to ride alone, would you mind sitting with me? And that lady, she took care of my kid all the way back to California. And I did what all heroes do at the end of the road. I went to mom's house. Told you about my mom. But what I didn't tell you is that my mother thought the sun rose and set on my daughter. That was her only granddaughter, and she loved that girl more than I've ever known her to love anybody in this world, man. And she hadn't heard nothing from us in a number of years. She opened that door, and she saw her granddaughter standing there with raggedy hair and dirty and crying, this raggedy old dress, holding on to this raggedy old doll. She grabbed that child, pulled her in the house. She put her finger on my chest. She said, "You ever come near me or her again?" I says, "I'll kill you. Get the hell off my property." And she took my daughter, thank God, and she saved her life. I know she did. Next 3 years, I don't know nothing about it. It's all hearsay. Luckily, a lot of it was documented. Started drinking Galliport wine. I lived in a little bamboo pasture in Carlsbad on State Beach, and you walk across Pacific Coast Highway, there was a little 7-Eleven there and a little biker bar. And I'd go up there, I'd panhandle for wine, I'd get a bottle of wine, I'd go back to my bush, you know, and that's what I did. I couldn't get no money. I'd stand in the doorway of that bar until someone ordered a pitcher of beer and went to the bathroom, and I'd run in and drink as much of their beer as I could before they got back and beat the hell out of me. I knew what willing to go to any length meant a long time before I came to AA, you know. And I lived that way for 3 years. And at the end, I was a tongue-chewing, babbling idiot. I'd lost the ability to talk. I'd been to county mental health I don't know how many times. I was arrested on that one corner for drunk in public 52 times in 1 year. And I stand in front of that 7-Eleven one morning. I was sicker than a dog, man. I got 65 cents. A short dog costs 87. You know, and I know I'm going to go into a seizure if I can't get a drink pretty quick. And this car pulled up, man, and it was this four-door sedan, this square dude with a suit on, short hair. You know, he's got this square little wife sitting next to him and this square little kid sitting in the back. I don't know how the hell they could live like that. But, who am I to judge, you know? This guy got out of the car and he walked over to me and he said, "Will this help you, buddy?" And he gave me two $1 bills. I almost tore his hand off taking it. You know, I ran in that store, I got me a quart of wine and a short dog, man. And I came back outside, I took that short dog, put it straight down. Held my face against that cold glass, man, until the shaking stopped. And I opened my eyes and I saw that family sitting in that car, reflection in the glass. And they were all looking at me and they were talking. And I knew they were judging me. And I turned around and flipped them off and cursed them. And went back to my bush, you know. And I'm laying in that bush, I'm sucking on that bottle of wine. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, I hear this. I don't know if it was an auditory hallucination. I don't know if it was someone in the bank yelling it. But someone said, "Maybe you ought to go to AA. I've been to AA, you know, and these detoxes and all these jails and all these, every once in a while, one of these 90-day wonders from Carlsbad would find me on the beach, want to rescue me, and I'd be patient with them. I'd tell them, I said, "Listen, man, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm a drug addict. I just can't afford any drugs." When I come walk in this room, man, and I don't know, it just kind of came through. You know, you hear a lot about blackouts. There's one step you go when you go past that. And I went way past that. I was in a blackout for 3 years. But every once in a while, I'd have a whiteout. And that's when you come to somewhere. Like right now, and all these people are looking at you. You don't know where you are, how you got there, what you did, why they're looking at you. You know, and then it fades to black. And then light comes back on. You're on your back. You're looking up. All these people are looking down at you. And it fades to black. Anyway, the light came on. I'm sitting in this room. There's a guy standing at the podium. There's all these squares. They all got short hair, wear shorts and stuff, you know, and they were clean. I thought it was a PTA meeting or something, you know. And this guy at the podium looks at me, he says, "Are you looking for AA? And I looked at him, that's what they wanted me to say, I guess. And he said, "Would you like to identify yourself?" I can't talk no more. I have brilliant thoughts. true epiphanies, you know, but from my brain to my mouth, not much comes out, you know. And he said, would you dinner? So I went, ah. And everyone's eyes got big. He smiled. He said, welcome. Have a seat. Well, I don't know what this is all about, man, but someone had told me that you guys would love me till I could love myself. I'll give you a little visual here. I weigh 110 pounds. My hair came way past my ass. My beard came down way past my belly button. I've been wearing the same clothes for 3 years. There's a lot of things living on me besides me. And I had a distinct aroma. I'd lost a lot of abilities. It just didn't seem that important anymore. And I saw this pretty little girl, and I said, she can love me. And so I sat down right next to her. She gasped and ran, you know. And so I'm sitting at this meeting, and I'm listening to them talk, you know, and they saw it pass me this basket. I took some money out of it. It went by. And they're talking about God. They're giving up stuff about themselves right in front of all these other people, man. And I'm going, oh, my God. This is the lamest thing I've ever seen in my life. You know, I need a drink, man. I got $3. I'm good to go. And I start to stand up. And there was this old gal, she kept looking at me from the minute I walked in that room. She kept smiling at me, you know, and I thought she was brain-damaged old woman. And I stood up to leave. I said, I ain't listening to any more of this bullshit. I got to get out of here. And I stood up to leave, and she stood up. This guy was talking. She cut him off cold. She said, you. I went, whoa. I thought I got busted for taking the money. She says, please don't go, son. She goes, I came in these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous 27 years ago in Long Beach, California. She got a woman, cops dropped me off there. They said they're tired of arresting me. And go in there and maybe those people could help. She goes, I walked in this room and I saw all these people, man, and they were all looking grand, you know. And I knew if they turned around and saw me and knew what I was, they wouldn't want me around them. She said, I've been on the streets of L.A. since I was 13 years old, did everything a woman ever did to survive out there. When I saw you people, I felt dirty. She said, but a woman grabbed hold of me and brought me into the rooms and got me involved with some other women and taught me how to be a lady. She proceeded to talk about 27 years of continuous sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she, all the time she's talking, she's getting closer to me. She's just kind of, she didn't want to spook me, you know. And pretty soon, man, she's right on top of me. And she reaches up and she grabs my head and she pulls my head down. And this little lady kissed me right on the mouth. The bravest woman I ever met in my life, man. And when she kissed me, she didn't let go, man. She put her arms around my neck and she started squeezing. And she said in my ear, she says, darling, she says, please, honey, please don't leave. We need you here desperately. Please don't go. Ain't nobody touched me with nothing but a stick for a long time. Ain't nobody told me they needed me or wanted anything to do with me. Ain't nobody in this world ever made me cry. But there I am. She said that to me and something inside broke, man. My belly started rumbling. Pretty soon my eyes are getting wet. Before you know it, I'm sniveling like a little schoolgirl right in front of the PTA, you know. And I started coming to A&A. And y'all lied to me right from the beginning. A bunch of you fools told me, just don't drink and go to meetings. I am not a problem drinker. Alcohol is not my problem. I have an acute allergic reaction to sobriety. Just not drinking and going to meetings, don't cut it for me. I'm going to tell you, at about 3 days, I'm ready to blow my brains out, or yours, you know. And I would go to these meetings. There was people in there, I noticed right off the bat, they had something I wanted. I couldn't put my finger on it. But it was a look in their eye, you know, and the way they carried themselves, man, I was attracted to it. I didn't know what it was, but I kept coming back. And I go back to that Thursday night workshop in Carlsbad, California on Thursday night. I really looked forward to that one. I'd walk in that thing so drunk, so messed up. And I'd walk in that room, and there was guys like Cliff R. and Skip and Bill Blake and a whole bunch of other old-timers in there. They would look at me, and their eyes would light up, and they would run across the room, and they'd say, "Oh, God, Kip, it's so good to see you." And not one of these guys told me what I had to do. They didn't tell me I had to do anything. They said, "Come on in. We're so glad you're here." And they welcomed me into these rooms. And they did that over and over, 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 and they were consistent. And that's what brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got brief periods of sobriety followed by a still worse relapse over and over and over. And it got worse and it got worse and it got worse and it got worse. I've been sober for almost 30 days on Christmas in 1983. And I started drinking. Got in a fight with a cop, lost. Just once, you know. They cheat. Get in a fight and try to call all your friends on a radio, you know. They beat my ass bloody, man. And I come to on Christmas morning, I'm hog-tied, butt naked one more time. Face first, laying on this mat. My blood had dried. My face was stuck to the mat, and I'm trying to pull my face up, you know, and I roll over, look up that porthole. Cops are looking at me laughing. I know Santa Claus ain't coming, you know. And they let me out of there. They knew me by my first name. They gave me my stuff. I had 90 bucks. I have no idea where it came from. I didn't ask no questions. I took it, and I made a conscious decision. I ain't going back to AA no more. I'm that person they talk about in chapter 5. I can't do this deal. It's impossible for me. I cannot live with alcohol. Maybe you guys can. God bless you. I can't live without alcohol. I can't imagine life without alcohol. And I went and spent every penny of that money on Gallo port wine. And I went back down to Little Hoots this Marine had let me move into. And I started sucking on that wine. And on January 6th, the worst thing that's ever happened to me since I landed on your planet. Alcohol stopped working. I was as physically drunk as a human being can possibly be. I'm talking knee-crawling drunk. But my mind was crystal clear. The loneliness was so intense. If it would have been a tangible thing, it would have eaten me alive. All those pictures I've been trying to hide, now they were in technicolor. The screaming in my head was so loud. And I knew, because I'd been to so many meetings, I read about that. So there'll come a time you cannot imagine life with alcohol or without it. And you've been coming to AA for a long time, and AA don't work for you. Oh, brothers and sisters, the day liquor stopped working for you, God help you. But you're going to know loneliness such as few people can even comprehend. You're going to come to the jumping off spot. And if you're like me, you're going to pull out your gun. You're going to pull it to your chest and pull the trigger. And I blew my left lung and two ribs out and knocked me all the way across the room. I'm sliding down this wall and I said, "Thank God this nightmare's over with. Let me out of here." And I come to in this hospital. You thought I died, didn't you? Yeah. Ain't the first time I've been shot. There's an old guy in A&A. I hated his guts, man. He said he'd been here so long, only had one A in it when he got here. You know, and, his name was Charlie Tuck. He was an old gangster from Chicago. And he came down, he got dead in my face in a meeting one time. He looked me right in the eye and he said, "You think you're pretty tough, don't you, kid?" Oh, man, I gave him my best mad dog look, man. I looked him right in the eye. I said, "Hey, old man, don't you ever doubt that I'm tough." He looked at me, he got this big grin, and he said, "You ain't tough." He said, "You're the scaredest son of a bitch in this room. That might make you dangerous, but it sure don't make you tough." and he walked away kind of giggling. I avoided that man like the plague. I'd go to meetings, man. I'd make sure I looked in all the windows, making sure that fool wasn't there. I come to. I've been in this coma for about a week, man. I come to. I got holes coming out of everything in my body that had a hole, and a whole bunch of holes I'd made. And I come to, and I hear this deep, gravelly voice, and I look up my eyes at the foot of my bed. There's Charlie Tuck standing there, and he's got these two dumb newcomers with him. And they're staring at me, and their eyes are as big as saucers, you know, and I know I've died, I've gone to hell, and this is it forever. Forever, man, I'm screwed. Old fool preaching A&A to me, and I'm chained to this gurney and can't get away, you know. Charlie Tuck didn't say one word to me. He put his arms around these two young men. He said, fellas, I want you to pay attention. Look at this man. Pitiful, ain't it? Get down there, get close to him. These guys get down there. Look at that. Come back here. And they come. He put his arm, he says, now, fellas, I want you to pay attention to this fool. This is what happens to an alcoholic who refuses to take the steps. Come on, let's go. They left. I felt cheap and used. I looked at those steps one time. They didn't apply to me. Said that, you know, I'm powerless. I've been packing a gun since I was 14 years old. Don't ever doubt I'm powerless, you know. My life's unmanageable. I like it that way. Mediocrity is my greatest fear, you know. Insanity. I've been seeing a psychiatrist since I was 9 years old. I tried to kill a kid because he took a Coke bottle from me. You know, and I had all these definitions of antisocial. So I'm already insane. What are they going to restore me to? That confused me. I went right past it. You know, talked about this God stuff. Hey, God ain't never cut me no slack. He ain't never cut me no slack. He likes those people who live up in the suburbs. People like me, he don't want nothing to do with. And I don't need him. You know, I drove right past that. It got to that other thing. It's about an inventory. I said, what the hell is this all about? He says, you got to write down everything you've ever done and admit it to another human being. I am a career criminal, and I pride myself in no paper trails of any of my activities. Now you want me to write everything down and share it with one of you lops. Ain't going to happen. I swear to God, it ain't going to happen. It got to the defects. What's this mean? I got to make amends. What's that mean? Because you got to go face every person you've ever harmed and make it right. I'm going, really? Loopy, don't shoot, man. Give me a minute. Wait a minute. Listen, I'm sorry I shot you and your brother and your dog and took all your stuff. But I'm in a spiritual manner of living today. You betcha, I can hardly wait to jump on that one, you know? I mean, there's places I can't go to, all their kinfolk are dead. Now you want me to hunt them down. Can't do that, man. None of this applies to me, you know? I didn't do those steps. They scared me to death, you know? I got out of that hospital in May, 1st of May. Do what I do, man, nothing works. I'm absolutely insane, stark raving, absolutely insane. Cannot sleep. I'm the loneliest human being. I'm dying. I want to die. They won't give me my gun back. You know? And I come to on May 12th, 1984, the same way I've come to 1,000 times. I come to and my first conscious thought is, I know I got to get something in my body now. But I've been to so many meetings, you guys have rotted my mind out, because what I heard that morning was that the ABCs, it's right at the end of chapter 5. Said that I'm an alcoholic, I'm powerless over alcohol. I got paperwork from the state of California classifying me as a chronic alcoholic. I have no denial about me being an alcoholic. See, that ain't the question. That question can't be answered by the state or a parole officer or a counselor or anyone else, whether I'm an alcoholic, that I'm powerless over alcohol. That comes in here where I live, where no one else can see. And God gave me a vision. And he gave me the vision that my daughter, my day she was born. And I felt that love exactly the way I felt it that morning. That intense love, knowing I would give my life for that child without a hesitation. And immediately switched. This old bum walking by, this little girl on a bus with a brown paper bag and this little girl crying because she's hungry. And I understood what powerless over alcohol meant. In here where I live, no doubts. I'm not just powerless over alcohol. Alcohol is my master. It tells me where I can go, when I can go, when I can go to bed and when I gotta get up. It tells me who I can be with, and if you ain't helping me drink, you got no place with me. And I got scared, but the next part said no human power is ever gonna fix me. Some of you gals in AA tried to fix me, and I'm gonna tell you straight up, man, you should have just listened to your sponsor. When I got that last part of the thing I've been avoiding since I walked in these rooms, I said, but God could and would if he were sought. And the people in Alcoholics Anonymous who had what I wanted, it wasn't their money, it wasn't their women, it wasn't their stuff. It was a look in their eye and the way they walked through life with dignity, always on the sunny side of the street, no matter what was going on with them. And they walked with dignity and purpose with no matter what was going on. And they all talked about the same thing. They talked about this power that had come into their life and did for them what they could not do. And I got down on my knees that morning. I said, I don't know who you are, and I don't know what you are, but from this point on, I'll do anything that you put in front of me if I don't have to drink. And if you're not there, I'm screwed. And I'm one of the very lucky ones, man. I'm one of God's favorite kids. Something happened inside of me. I don't even have the vocabulary to tell you. But I knew, all capital letters, I knew without a shadow of a doubt that if I could hold on to that, I wasn't going to have to drink. And I immediately got over to Charlie Tuck's house. Where else am I going to go? Charlie came out, and he says, what can I do for you? I said, Charlie, I don't want to drink no more. Will you help me? He said, you've been saying that for years. What's different? I said, I don't know, but I'll, you know, Charlie, I said, I don't know nothing about God, but I'll pray to your God. He says, are you done? I said, God, I hope so. And he said, all right, son. He said, sit down. I got some good news for you, and I got some bad news. Bad news is people like you don't get sober. People like you die in institutions. You die on the side of the road. They don't even mention your name. Good news is this. I've been around here for a while, and I can see a little sparkle in your eye, and I know what that is. God's opened a door for you. And this is the way it's going to have to be for you one day at a time, all the days of your life. One simple concept that absolutely nothing, no woman, no job, no child, no nothing can ever be more important than you doing the things that you must do to maintain your sobriety. And son, that's a hell of a lot more than just going to AA meetings. He goes, you willing to do it? I said, I'll do whatever you tell me. He said, follow me. It was on Mother's Day, and he lived right at Holiday Park, and all these families were there for Mother's Day picnics, and he walked right in the middle of this crowd, and he dropped on his knees, and he looked at me, and I said, what are you doing? He said, we're going to pray. I said, in front of all these people? He said, Kip, he said, the only hope you got is that God's going to give you some grace. If you're ashamed of God already, don't waste my time or his. He started to get up, man. I dropped to my knees. I said, no, wait, wait. And that old man took my hands and he did the third step prayer with me. And he took me back to his house. He had a little room in the back. And he detoxed me over the next 5 days. Caro syrup and orange juice and a little bit of whiskey. And all the men he sponsored came over and took turns watching me and cleaning me when I messed myself and held me when I shook. And when I went into a convulsion, they put things around me so I wouldn't hurt myself. They started feeding me a little bit of broth. You know, and Charlie loved Norm Alpe. He'd have those old reel-to-reel, 6 hours of Norm Alpe, man. They were just went on and on and on, you know. And it was Norm was always talking. And, you know, and after 5 days, Charlie walked in that room. He looked at me and he said, all right, son. Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of action. Are you ready? You know, I was at the old timers meeting this morning, and they were talking about what your favorite saying in AA was. Mine's not in the book or any of that. This is what Charlie told me. I said, "What do? He said, "Get in the car." That's my favorite words in AA. I didn't get sober in AA meetings. I got sober sitting in the back seat of meetings with two old-timers up front driving me up and down the coast, going to meetings, going on 12-step calls, going on H&I, listening to these old-timers talk. And I always started with, "Get in the car." I said, "Where are we going?" He said, "We're going to detox." I said, "I'm detoxed. It ain't for you, fool. We're going to go carry the message." I went, "Oh, okay." Charlie was blind, and he got a lost an eye in a fight in Chicago, and he had a glass eye on his right eye. He had this big old Cadillac. He'd get up on Interstate 5, put those front wheels on those little bumps, and look at me and start talking. And we would drive by Braille all the way to San Diego. And by the time you got there, you knew this man you got on a first-name basis, you know. We pulled into detox at 111 Island Street down San Diego. I got sober there 100 times, you know. I knew the staff. I knew everybody in there. I walked in with Charlie. They thought he was dropping me off, you know. And he said, "No, he's with me." He goes, "Oh, really? Okay." So I walk in. I know all these guys on the mats. And Charlie, can we bring him in? And Charlie gives him in his pitch. And he said, "Now I want you to meet my friend Kip. He hasn't had a drink in 5 days." I looked at these guys, and they're going, "Yeah." I said, "Listen, fellas, you know me. I ain't going to lie to you. But it's true, I ain't had a drink in 5 days. And that ain't no big deal. But if something I can't figure out is, I haven't wanted a drink in 5 days. I haven't been obsessed to take a drink in 5 days. I don't know what this is all about any more than you do. But this fella does. And what he's got is a hell of a lot better than what I got. And I'm sticking with him. You know, and that's all I said." And these guys all wanted to talk to me after the meeting, you know. And we walked out of that meeting, and he said, "How do you feel?" I said, "What do you mean? How do you feel?" He said, "Wow, man, I don't know. It's powerful. That is the music of Alcoholics Anonymous, son. And you can never hear that or feel that unless you're giving it away. He says, "Come on, let's get busy." And that old man lined me out on a course of action. He had me moving and shaking. And I was at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every single day. I had to get there early, shake hands with every person that walked in that room. I couldn't hug no women. He said, "You know, don't ask them how they are. Act like you care. Don't tell them anything about you, except in a general way, unless they ask. Don't borrow any money from anyone. Don't borrow any cigarettes from anyone. Leave." He says, "Well, as soon as they ask for help for something, maybe make sure your hand is first in the air. And after the meeting, you'll stay and help clean it up, no matter if they got someone to clean it up already or not. You're going to help clean it up, because that's what gratitude is. Gratitude is action. It's not word. You know, you ain't got no right to be in there. That's a privilege to be in there for someone like you. You pay them back as you go." And he said, "I want you to get a job." And I said, "I don't know how to job." "Well, what do you mean to get a job?" He says, "You got to get a job." I said, "Well, I don't know how to do anything, really." And he said, "Well, get on your knees. You know how to pray?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "Get on your knees and pray. Tell God you need a job." And I was 36 years old. I got on my knees. I said, "You know, Charlie says, I need a trade. I'll take whatever you got." And I got up, and I did the action. I put one foot in front of the other. I walked out. I was going to hitchhike into town. This pickup truck rolled up. He said, rolled a window down. He said, "Hey, you want a job?" It scared me to death, you know. I go, "What is it?" He goes, "It's painting." I said, "I don't know how to paint." He said, "I'll teach you." I said, "I haven't got a car." He says, "My shop's right there." I said, "Okay." Called Charlie up. "Charlie, I got a job." He goes, "What is it?" "It's painting." He thought for a minute. He goes, "That's a good job for you. You don't have to think very much." One of the most important words that Charlie Tuck taught me that has saved my life is one of the most powerful words in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is called commitment. It means something different in here than it means out there. commitment, when you tell someone in AA, you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, that you're going to do something, the only excuse is you died on the way there. That's the way I was raised in Alcoholics Anonymous. You used up all your excuses the day before you got here. You are accountable. You are responsible for all of your actions, all of your reactions to their actions, and all of your inactions. And you stay focused on those three actions, you'll keep your nose out of everybody else's business. And that's the way it was. You know, when I went to work for this guy, I found out that I was a painter. I didn't know that. And I worked for that man for 2 years. He also told me, he said, you make a commitment to work for him for a minimum of 2 years. You'll do whatever he tells you as long as it's legal, honest, and ethical. Because you'll never ask him what he's paying you, whatever he pays you more than you're worth. You thank him every day at the end of the job for your job. Your job is to make him money. That's it. Go. And that's what I did. You know, I worked my way up in 2 years as lead man on the 150-man crew. I was the only sober person there. The absolute only sober. Let me tell you how my home group started. I ain't got no driver's license. I'm never going to have a driver's license. And this guy, Steve, he says, he's giving me a ride home from the job. He says, you're in that AA, aren't you? I ain't giving nothing up, man. I go, why? Because I know people that know you. And I see you at lunchtime. I know what that book you're reading is. I said, so what do you ask? He goes, well, I'd like to go back to AA, but man, I just don't want to raise my hand again. It's too embarrassing. I said, really? How long have you been doing that? He goes, 6 months. I laughed. I didn't tell him about 5 years of doing it, you know. And I said, I'll tell you what, man, I live right behind this bar. And I did. I live right behind this bar, man. Their back door was right next to my front door. I like it that way. I said, come on to my house. Me and you will sit out in front of the book on Thursday night. Because I have a hell of a time getting to a meeting that night. And me and you will sit down. We'll study this book. And after 30 days, 90 days, you can go back and you won't have to raise your hand. Nobody will know. He goes, really? I said, yeah. And so he started coming over. You know, Steve started getting sober. Pretty soon another guy out there. He's coming. After a year, there's 50 guys in my front yard every Thursday night. Right, oh, yeah. We tell them straight up, man, you don't want what we got. Walk on in, baby. You can crash here tonight. You won't even get a 502. That meeting is about 150 men in one of the most active AA groups around in Southern California, down in that area. We put on two men's conferences a year. And I invite all of you there, man, at www.backtobasics. That two is T-W-O. You know, and every year with 30%, we take brand new newcomers that ever got nothing, man. They got nothing. Either they just got out of the joint, most of them, ain't got anything to go on, and we take them up there and give them 3 days of solid, real, old school A&A. You know, and we eat like pigs, you know, and you're all invited. You know, I think that happened in my life quick. At 10 years sobriety, I had it all, man. I became a very, very successful, wealthy contractor, painting contractor. I'm working up at Nellie Gale Ranch, just one millionaire after another. And I got about 20 people working for me full time. And, you know, I've got the big house. I've got the boat. I've got everything in the world I dreamed about. I met a girl. She liked to fish. She got sober on the same day as I did. Had to be my soulmate, you know. So we got married. I got custody of my children. You know, I still owned a lot of property with my ex-wife that we'd never settled up on. And she wanted me to settle up on it. And I went over and I said, I'll tell you what, you give me custody of my kids and I'll sign all this over to you. And I signed $1.5 million worth of commercial property over to her for custody of my kids. And I got my kids back, you know. And at 3 years sobriety, the state of California gave me my driver's license back, you know. And I went, my sponsor wouldn't let me buy anything on credit, you know, and I had enough money, I went and bought a brand new Ford pickup, paid cash, you know, and I came home with my new truck, and the phone was ringing, and my wife said, this girl wants to talk to you. I said, who is it? And she goes, I don't know. And I said, hello. She goes, your name Kip? I said, yeah. She goes, "Do you know so-and-so?" I said, "Man, a long time ago." She goes, "That's my mother, and you're my father. And I've been looking for you for a long time. And I want you to meet your grandchildren, you know." And that little girl that was born all that time ago, she came back into my life and brought me these beautiful grandchildren.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
You know, and I got to go make amends to that family and to the mom and everything, and they became part of my life. That little boy that they told me to pray that he died. See, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I met a lot of men who had handicapped children. And I started learning. I started going to classes and learning how to be a parent of a handicapped child. And I got my son involved in a very neat school up in Riverside, California. At the age of 23 years old, my whole home group was there, all these outlaws, you know. And we watched my son walk down the aisle in that little hat and graduate from high school. That little girl that I drug all over the country, man came to me and said one day, he said, "Sir, my name is Sean." And I said, "I've heard of you." I says, "Yeah." I said, "I want to marry your daughter." And my daughter said, "Your daughter said I have to have your permission." I traded that right for a bottle of wine. You know, the day she was born, I planned her wedding. You know, and I was able to give her. I said, "You drink?" He said, "No." I said, "You got a job?" He goes, "Yeah, I'm a pilot, captain for American Airlines." I said, "Oh, that'll come in handy." Old ideas, what can you do, you know? He said, "You can marry my daughter under one condition." He goes, "What's that?" I said, "If you ever raise a hand at anger in my daughter, don't you ever sleep in the same place twice. Do you understand?" I go, "Yeah." I said, "I'm not joking, man. Do you understand?" And he said, "Yes, sir." I said, "All right." And I gave her a wedding. They've been married for 15 years. I finished paying for that wedding last year. Okay. 10 years sober, I had it all, man. And I went to Australia. I spoke in Sydney. And I spent about a month over there, and I came back, and I opened up the newspaper, and in the front story, there's a story about a man who broke into this woman's house and raped her in front of her children all night. And when he was done with her, he took a knife and he cut her to pieces. And it was my daughter. When you come in here, we ask you if you're willing to go to any lengths. When you're new, you haven't got a clue what that means. I'm perfectly capable of first-degree murder, especially if you touch anything of mine. My daughter didn't die, but she lost her face, she lost her breast, and she lost her right arm. And I went to that hospital, and she didn't even look human. And my heart, I don't know anything about anger. I hear these guys say I'm pissed. I drive right past that, you know. I get ice cold inside. I start making plans for your future. And I don't talk to nobody about it because I don't like co-defendants. You know. He's in jail. I got a good brother of mine that's in the same jail. This is going to be taken care of. He owes me a big one too. You know. And I'm struggling. I ain't talking about nothing to nobody, man. I'm just kind of just shut down. And I'm getting sicker and I'm getting sicker. And I'm reading that big book. I'm looking for a loophole. And someone here got a resentment they're having trouble getting with. I'm going to tell you, man, I read it page to page. All it says, if there is a resentment I can't get rid of, I got to get it on my knees and pray for that human being to have everything in life that I want. And I got to do that for 20 days. The hardest thing I've ever done in my life was to get on my knees and pray for that animal and not pass his name on a piece of paper. And I didn't have to drink, and I didn't have to hurt nobody, and I didn't have to hurt myself. And I was there, and I had the financial ability to take care of my daughter and my grandchildren, get them the help they needed. And they worked one more time. I was able to go talk about what was going on with me to the men of my group. I was able to start crying and start feeling that, letting that pain out. Or because I found these men, I got some hardcore gangsters. And I've cried in their arms, and they've cried in mine. And I ain't ashamed of it, you know. And let me get healed from that. And they were there with me. Right after that, they told me I had cancer. They're going to have to do this major surgery on me. I said, I can't do it. He goes, why not? I said, because I can't take your pain medication. He goes, it's going to kill you. I said, I don't care. I said, you know what? I'm not real smart. The only thing I really know is it's so much easier to stay sober than to get sober again. You know, I said, I can't take it. He said, well, we're going to do this surgery. I don't know if you can go with it, but we'll do it if you want. And they did it. And I did it with no dignity whatsoever. I sniveled like a little bitch, man. I whined and cried. And all the guys I sponsor came over. They took care of me. They were right there with me the whole time, just laughing like hell, you know. But they were with me, you know, and they took care of me. And I got through that. You know, I come home from work one day and my wife is crying. I love this woman, man. First woman I ever really was intimate with. And I ain't talking about sex. I'm talking about I took off all the armor and let her look at me and she didn't back up, you know. And I come home and she's crying. I said, what's the matter? She goes, I can't do this no more. I'm going to drink. I said, what are you talking about? She goes, I'm a lesbian and I'm in love with Chrissy and I'm leaving. I didn't know. I thought I forgot to take the trash out or something, you know. I don't know what to do about this. You know, but we have joined the Catholic Church, and I got this godfather. He was a great member of Alcoholics Anonymous. His name just happened to be Father Bill Wilson, you know. So I'm going to rat her out to the church, man. I run down to La Jolla, down to All Hallows, and I make an appointment to go see the priest and go in there with Father Bill. Unfortunately, Bill was a sober member of AA. And I walk in and I start telling the story, you know, and he's going, oh, Lord. Oh, you poor thing. Oh, Kip, you must feel like life has screwed you square in the ass. I said, you got it, Father. That's just how it feels. He goes, I said, what do you think? Well, I'm hoping we're talking excommunication, you know, maybe. Let's get the Knights of Columbus to go round her up, you know. And he says, you ever read that book you're always talking about? I go, yeah. He says, why don't you try practicing something that it says in there? Because you make me sick. You come in here, you're telling me you did this, you did that. You're such a great husband. You're such a great father. You're such a this, this, this. Did you do all that out of love? Or did you do it because you expected something back from it? You remind me of that guy on page 61 that said, I feel like I could rest satisfaction out of life if I do everything just right. Because the next page over there, there's a keto thing. It's before you even do the third step. Bottom of page 62. It says, here's the how and the why of it. First of all, before you do anything, you got to quit playing God. You're not in charge of her sexuality. You have enough trouble with your own. I said, what do I do? He goes, you go back and you apologize to her and her girlfriend. You give her a divorce and you give her anything she wants. She's been a good wife to you. She's a good member of the church. She's a good member of AA. So I went back to her and I did that. And she took my boat. That ain't right. And that was Connie, and I love Connie, and Connie loves me. And see, I learned something in Alcoholics Anonymous. Our marriage was based on Alcoholics Anonymous, the principles. I respect her as a woman. I respect her as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I respect for the lady that she is. And it was time for the relationship to change, that's all. She tells everyone that I'm her sister, our brother, you know? And she is. She's my sis, you know? And I love her, and we stay in contact. And we got sober on the same day, and we still give tokens to each other every once in a while, you know. And she babysits my kids sometimes, you know. You know, and I got through that, and I didn't have to hurt nobody. And then I got attacked by this damn dog and almost tore my right arm off. And I'm bleeding to death in this hospital, man. And I call up the Scotty. He's an old outlaw Vietnam vet biker group. And I said, listen, man, they're taking me to the hospital. I'm bleeding to death. Get there. Make sure they don't put any dope in me, man. When the ambulance pulled up, there was 20 bikes there. These guys all in leather surrounded the gurney. Said, don't give this man any narcotics. With authority. And those guys stuck with me, man. They stuck with me. They said that hospital, they inspected everything that went in my body. You know, you don't give anything this guy that affects him from the neck up. You know, but the second day I'm going, hey, man, give it a break. Come on. But, you know, those guys took care of me. And that's the way it's been for me. That's been since I got here. I've never had to go through anything alone. You know, the last time I went to jail, I stood at that phone in a town that I was born and raised in. And I got that one phone call, and there wasn't one human being on the face of the earth that would accept a collect telephone call from me. I don't ever want to forget that, you know. You know, everything was going to, last thing that happened, it was just me and my son. You know, I couldn't work no more. I lost my business. I lost my home. I lost everything, the clothes on my back, an old pickup, my dog and my son. And my son got sick. We had to go in for another surgery, and he got sicker, and I sat in that hospital with him for the next 3 months. On October 4th, 1993, I came in early that morning, and he said, he was really excited. He spoke sign language. He said, Daddy, he says, you don't have to worry about me no more. I said, what do you mean? He says, God came and talked to me this morning. He said, he's going to take care of me from now on, and you're free. You don't have to worry about me no more. I didn't know what he was talking about, but I spent the whole day with him, you know, and that night I kissed him, and I said, I'll see you tomorrow. And I went home, and I no sooner got home, the phone rang, and they told me my son had got into a coma, and there was absolutely no brain activity whatsoever. He'd had a seizure. And I got back to that hospital, and I had to make the decision to pull the plug. And I pulled the plug, and I held on to his body as he went through those last gasping convulsions, his body trying to breathe. And I hurt more than any human being. I didn't know it possible to hurt that much. I didn't know you could hurt that much. But I'm going to tell you something. In the middle of that, that's when I discovered one of the main promises. I found out what serenity is. See, I know what serenity means. Serenity was watching the love of my life die and leave me. And hurting more than I knew it was human possibly to hurt. But at exactly the same time and an equal balance, knowing without a shadow of a doubt that this is God's business and God don't make mistakes. And I got down on my knees and I thanked the God of my understanding for all of you men who taught me how to be the father I dreamed about being the day he was born. Because you guys did that. You taught me how to be the kind of father I dreamed about being. You know, I thank the members of Alcoholics Anonymous that helped me through all these things. I gave my son, washed him down, and I shaved him for the last time, and I gave him back to God. And I went back home, and you know, all the guys I sponsored, there was about 50 bikes out in front of my house, and all these guys were sitting in there waiting for me. You know, and I walk in, and I've been up all night, and I'm just devastated. And Scotty, old outlaw, he's sitting there. He says, hey, man, that new guy Herman you've been working with, he's been calling all morning. I said, man, I'm done. I can't talk to nobody. And the phone rang right then, and it was Herman. Scotty goes, what do you want to do? I said, give the phone. I pick up the phone. I said, Herman, listen, man, my son just died in my arms about 45 minutes ago. Man, I am empty. I got nothing to offer you. He goes, hey, that's too bad. But this is really important. Swear to God. Nothing self-centered about him. And you know, immediately I went, ooh, you know. And then I went, he's right. My primary purpose isn't to be a father. It's not to be a husband. It's not to be... My primary purpose is to carry this message. Anytime anyone, anywhere reaches out, I want the hand of AA to be there. And for that, I am responsible. No one else. He was reaching out to me. And I said, "You're right, Herman. Why don't you come on over and we'll talk it out, brother?" And he came over. And Herman's still sober, and so am I. And Herman saved my ass. You know, I didn't have nothing. It was all gone. I said, "What do I do now, Charlie?" He says, "Go to school, get an education." I followed directions as given to my sponsor. I said, "I don't know how to go to school." He goes, "It's just like AA." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "The teacher's your sponsor. The answers are in the book. Show up on time, suit up and show up and follow all directions given." He's right. School's just like AA, you know. I graduated. I got a degree. Big deal, you know. But I got that. I went into a whole different line of work, you know, and my sponsor told me, to, you know, "I want you to stay away from women." I told him. I said, "You know, I'm really lonely." He says, "You're not lonely. You're horny." I said, "No, you don't understand. I'm the kind of guy I need to have a relationship." And he said, "Hold it. Let me explain something to you, son. It's absolutely impossible for an alcoholic to have a relationship if he needs to be in one. That is not a relationship." He says, "You stay away from women, you'll hurt somebody and you'll poke your eye out, you know." I said, "Well, can I date?" He said, "Keep it real light." And I did. You know, I'm going to school. I'm taking 24 units, so there ain't much time for anything else. But this one woman took advantage of me. You guys know, you got to watch them. They'll do it. Caught me in a moment of weakness. And, you know, I graduated from college and the next year, and after that, I'm sitting there, and this gal called me up. She said, "Hey, you've been alone for a long time, haven't you?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "I was just thinking about that. Why don't you come on over, and I'll make you dinner, and maybe we can mess around." I went, "Wow." I said, "You know, sounds good, but I got a pot of beans on the stove and a sheet of cornbread. Me and my dog are watching this game. Maybe I could take a rain check." And she hung up on me. I went, "Oh, that's cool." And so I went, all of a sudden, you know, I said, and we suddenly realized, you know, I went, "Whoa. I would have jumped on that so fast, she wouldn't have got the phone hung up before I got over there, you know. But my sponsor told me I couldn't have a woman until I didn't need a woman to validate me as a man. I had to like me. I had to like my company. I like to like who I am before I had anything to offer to anybody else." And I went, "You know what? I like me. I like my company. I think you women are the greatest thing to come around since liquor, you know. But I don't need any of you, you know. I am a full human being without any woman in my life, you know." And I went, "Thank you, Father, but I'd love to experience true life, true love one more time if it be your will." And I let it go. You know, 2 weeks later, I get a phone call, and it was the girl's mother. She goes, "Oh, she got in a car wreck last night, got massive brain damage. She's never getting out of the hospital." I said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. Is there anything I can do?" She goes, "You can come and pick up your daughter." I said, "My daughter? What are you talking about?" She goes, "You have a three-month-old daughter. I'm raising no more kids. What do you want to do with it?" And I drove up there in Burbank, and she opened the door. She said, "You Kip?" I said, "Yeah." She handed me a bassinet, diaper bag, and a sheet of paper. She said, "Good luck, sailor, you know." And I looked at her. She's got my nose, my eyes, and she smiled at me, and my heart exploded in my chest. God gave me exactly what I asked for, true love. Ain't none of you women truly ever loved me. It's always been contingent upon my actions, you know. I came back down, you know, and everyone, the guy saying, "You got to get a blood test, make sure that's your baby." I said, no. God gave me this baby. I ain't giving her back. I never have got a blood test. I don't care. But all these outlaws, they threw me a baby shower. It's the funniest thing you ever seen in your life, man. You ever seen so many motorcycles, leather and ink show up at a baby shower in your life, man? And all these guys showed up, and we did it just like the women did. You know, we played all these games, silly, it was bullshit. We cracked up. It was fun, you know. And it was just me and my daughter, you know, and everything's going great. One time, you know, I met this woman that I've known her for years. We've been on many committees together, and she asked to hold my daughter, and I said, "Yeah, you can hold her." And I let her hold on, looking at the way she was looking at her, man, and I don't know, man. I went up after the meeting, and I said, so how's your husband? She goes, we got a divorce last year. I said, you did? How come? And she goes, well, I wanted to have children. He didn't. I went, oh, I'm so sorry. And I asked her out on a date, and I dated my wife. We went out, and we started to get to know each other. And we talked about everything. Politics, religion. She has a deep love of Alcoholics Anonymous. She's been sober as long as I have, and she's every bit as active as I am. And I fell head over heels in love with her and her with me. And she proposed to me, you know. And we got married. And 13 years ago, I went in and I cut the cord on a little boy. You know, and his name is Will. And Will's the sunshine of my life, man. When we first got him, I said, it's got to be God's will at my age. And then I got to know him, and he's self-will run riot, just like his dad. The way it is for me today is I live in a home up on top of a hill. My house is paid for. My sponsor did not believe in credit. He said, giving you credit is like giving a five-year-old kid a shotgun. You know? He made me pay my way as I go, and I've managed to get through all this recession and very comfortably, you know, and everything that's going on. I have a business where I've driven my kids to school every single day since they started school. I've been involved in their school, and I have opinions, and I am a member of two different PTAs, you know. I've been involved in my kids' life. I'm an active participant in their family. They have never seen their daddy drunk. They've never seen their daddy hit no one. They've never seen their daddy yell at their mother. And my house is a safe place to be, you know. My house is usually full of newcomers. My wife is very active sponsoring people. I got a garden that I spent 10 years building just to worship my God at. You know, and there's been about probably over 200 fifth steps given at this one table. And if it could take it, man, we could sure lock a lot of people up. That thing could talk, you know. You know, and every single 4th of July, I have a great big giant party at my house with members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you're all invited, you know. Let me call my wife first, though. So. I'm telling you straight up, here's the deal. Alcoholics Anonymous is outlined in the first 164 pages of the big book. Will work for absolutely anybody, anywhere, under any circumstances. It doesn't matter what you've done or what you haven't done. This thing works, and it works good. My sponsor gave me one last promise. I was holding his hand before he died, Charlie. He said, Kip, he says, you've come a long way, but you've got so far to go, you know? And he said, you know, but if you keep doing what you're doing, around midnight when there ain't no one around to impress, when it's just you, you're going to walk by a mirror, and you're going to see the man that you dreamed about being when you were a little boy. And that has come to pass. I am no big deal, but I'll tell you, as a result of your love, Alcoholics Anonymous, I am the best man in every aspect of my life that I have ever been. And I want to thank you for my life and thank you for your time. That's all I have for you.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.